talking history. This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're debating the fall of Singapore, and we'll find out why Winston Churchill considered it the worst disaster and largest capitulation in British history. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text, 53106. Text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we explored the life and legacy of one of the great Victorian explorers, David Livingstone, of Dr. Livingstone, I presume, fame. And we discovered how he captured the imagination of his age. And if you'd like to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. Tonight's debate is on the fall of Singapore. During the Second World War, Singapore was the main defensive position of the British Empire in the Far East. By the end of January 1942, Singapore was cut off from outside help, and in February, the Japanese stormed the island with an all-out assault. The defenders surrendered on the 15th of February to prevent the city being pillaged and destroyed. As Professor Brian Farrell has shown, it was nothing less than a military humiliation and a political disaster. And in tonight's show, we want to debate what really happened and whether it was really as much of a disaster as Winston Churchill claimed. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Professor Brian Farrell is Professor of Military History at the National University of Singapore, and his books include the definitive Defence and Fall of Singapore, and he's the co-editor of 60 Years On, The Fall of Singapore Revisited. Dr. Peter Dye served in the Royal Air Force for 35 years, retiring as Air Vice Marshal, and later served as the Director General of the Royal Air Force Museum. And he's the author of The Man Who Took the Rap, Sir Robert Brooke Popham and the Fall of Singapore. Dr. Ian Speller is Director of the Centre for Military History and Strategic Studies in the Department of History at Maynooth University, and his books include Understanding Naval Warfare. Well, you're all very welcome, and later in the show I'll be talking to Jingjing Li, a Singaporean novelist and the author of How He Disappeared, a novel which is set in World War II Singapore. Well, as I say, you are all very welcome, and Brian, you are very welcome, especially because you're joining us from Singapore, and I think it's the middle of the night your time, so thanks a million for getting up for this discussion. And can I begin with something that is on the cover of your book? And it's a quote from the distinguished historian Hugh Strawn, who we've had on the show before. And he describes this as a battle that marked the end of the British Empire. And I wonder, is the fall of Singapore, is the Battle of Singapore as significant as all of that?
Well, good morning. Delighted to be here. Thanks very much for the invitation. That's an interesting quote from you. I'd say maybe if we see it as a time bomb. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the empire as an ongoing political project persisted for another quarter century, and British armed forces didn't finally leave Singapore until 1971, and then the local government didn't want them to go. But the psychological and political impact of a British-led army being defeated by an Asian great power, the speed and the ease with which that happened, I think that did change the question. That changed the question from what would one day happen to the British presence in the Far East to, when would they leave and under what terms and conditions? So I guess I would say that that defeat planted a time bomb which started ticking on the empire east of Suez.
And Brian, you begin your book with a discussion of the Singapore strategy going back to 1919 and what the British were planning. And it seems that there were failures kind of built into it from the very beginning because they weren't really putting the resources to match the strategy.
Well, that's a fair comment. I mean, it was obvious after 1918 that there would have to be a reduction in defense expenditure. Homes fit for heroes were required. The world had been made safe for democracy. The war to end all wars had been won. A new dawn beckoned. But under no circumstances was anybody prepared to downsize the empire, and it had been built in an earlier time when British power was much greater. In fact, if anything, it expanded as new responsibilities were taken on in the Middle East. And absolutely the last thing that successive British governments were prepared to do was confess that they could no longer, unaided, maintain and protect their imperial position in Asia. So they had to figure out a way to square the circle. And over time, the decision was made that, well, we will take a military risk in order to maintain the political position that we have, what we hold, and we will not back away. And to be fair, under the circumstances in 1919, 20, 21, when these decisions were made, there was no imminent threat. There was no great, direct, clear and present danger. It wasn't an unviable plan. We'll build the infrastructure, and if necessary, we'll deploy the resources. The issue was, could the plan be adjusted and adapted to meet changing circumstances? And over time, sadly for all concerned, that proved not to be the case.
Very good. And we are, as I say, delighted that Brian has been able to join us. It's 3:08 in the morning at Brian's time in Singapore. Peter, you're also very welcome to the show, and your book is on the man who took the rap. It seems that a few people, in a way, took the rap, because General Percival has also been blamed by some people for the fall of Singapore. And there does seem to be problems in the pre-war planning on the British side.
Good evening, Peter. Yes, I mean, I think I would certainly agree with everything Brian was saying, but the planning was suffered from the same problem that he was discussing, really, which was the ambition was much greater than the resources available, and they weren't really able to adapt. Now, what they anticipated the Japanese would do was actually fairly close to what did happen. But the response, or the planned response, really assumed much greater forces than they had. So there was this anomaly, dichotomy, let's say, between what they wanted to do and what they could do. And I think that put the British and Commonwealth forces on the back foot. They really couldn't move as fast as the Japanese. Their plans were frail because they were under-resourced. And the outcome was, I suppose, inevitable, although it was a huge shock to the British public and indeed to world opinion. But actually, looking at what they were trying to do and the resources to do it, it was, I think, inevitable that Singapore would fall.
And there was a plan that had been devised for the defence of the whole region, codenamed Matador. And there seems to have been some problems in implementing that or giving the go signal for that to go into effect.
Yes, you're quite right. I mean, it's debatable whether Matador could have succeeded, because the forces that Robert Brooke Popham had assumed in his planning that he would have were not there. But even so, they hadn't really thought through how they could react in time. There was an assumption that they would have adequate warning, and also could conduct a debate with Whitehall about whether they should launch Matador. Now, Matador involved invading a neutral country, Thailand, to actually thwart the Japanese advance from the north. But, of course, that would have, if the Japanese hadn't been planning to attack Thailand and indeed attack Malaya, it would have been a disaster, and it might have alienated American opinion for good. So Brooke Popham, I don't think, nor the chiefs of staff, have fully thought out how he could bring that operation about without running significant risk. And, of course, all of this led to confusion and delay, and Matador, in the end, was cancelled. But, of course, they then found themselves between two stools, because Matador involved an advance into Thailand, and the alternative was actually to defend your ground and wait for the Japanese. But the process of changing from the offensive to defensive actually put the Allied forces at a huge disadvantage. And once the Japanese had the upper hand, they continued to move much quicker than the British could decide on the response. So Matador was in many ways a disaster, although actually in retrospect it probably was the right strategy if they'd only had the resources and if they'd thought through the decision making.
Ian, you're an acclaimed naval historian, and part of this story is the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the repulse, and this happens 3 days after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, which brings the United States into the war. So can you tell us about that engagement and maybe situate this in the context of what's happening in terms of the wider war?
Sure. Well, the problem with Singapore's strategy is It's based around the idea that Singapore will be this key base and that the British will move a major fleet there if the Japanese pose a threat. But those are plans made in the interwar period in the 20s and 30s when Britain isn't facing a situation that actually has in 1941. In 1941, Britain is facing the combined strength of the Italian and the German fleets in Europe and is hanging on by its fingertips. So when Japan poses a threat in the summer and the autumn of 1941, there is very, very little that can be sent to Singapore, and certainly Britain cannot send the balanced, capable fleet that they were planning to do. So they then face a dilemma. What the Royal Navy want to do is to slowly build up a capable fleet in the Indian Ocean and not base anything really in Singapore, because they recognise that they can't put a force they're able to take on the Japanese. But they come under pressure, particularly from Winston Churchill, to make some kind of a gesture, to send a force that will be a signal of British resolve and maybe that will contribute to deterring the Japanese from acting. So eventually it's decided to send the new battleship, the Prince of Wales, and the battle cruiser, the Repulse, to base at Singapore. But that's not really a viable wartime force. It's certainly not a capable, balanced fleet. It's not something that could take on the Japanese with any real prospect of success. The idea really is that it will send a signal to Japan, and that might be enough to make the Japanese wary of going to war. And it also sends a signal to the United States to say that Britain is taking this seriously, that Britain is willing to commit to the Far East, and that if war occurs against the Japanese, then the British and the Americans will go together. So in a peacetime strategy, it makes some sort of sense. But once Japan actually makes that decision to go to war, when the deterrent fails, then what you're left with are these two powerful ships that really are very ill-placed to actually achieve anything decisive in the context of protecting Singapore and Malaya. And possibly what they should do is actually withdraw and pull back into the Indian Ocean, which would strategically make more sense. But that would be a decision that would have all sorts of political ramifications. So what actually happens is Admiral Phillips, in charge of Force Z, which is this force built around those two big ships, decides to sortie to try and stop Japanese troops landing in North Malaya. And he sends these two ships with a handful of destroyers out to try and deal with those Japanese convoys in the face of overwhelming Japanese air superiority, this very powerful land-based air force, against which he really has no serious defence. And the end results are the loss of those two ships, which is, in retrospect, perhaps almost inevitable, but it is at the time, of course, a devastating and a humiliating blow for the British.
And Brian, this transforms or changes what they hoped Singapore could be used for, because it's no longer going to be that kind of base of operations for demonstrating British power in the region. Instead, it reduces it to just being a place of a fortress to defend.
Yeah, if I can pick up on the point that my colleague just made, and I think he made it very eloquently, and I don't disagree with him at all. The right play would have been to pull the two capital ships away, perhaps send them down to Batavia to link up with the Dutch. But that's a decision for the National Command Authority. I'd like to just put in a word for Admiral Phillips under the circumstances here. It would certainly have been right and proper for Prime Minister Churchill and Admiral Pound, the first Sea Lord, to overrule any decision that Admiral Phillips wanted to make and to order him as a priority of grand strategy to withdraw, to link up with Allied forces, to menace the Japanese as a fleet in being. But he's the man on the spot. He's the commander of the naval presence in Singapore, and the armed forces, the Air Force and the Army up north in northern Malaya, are under attack. There's absolutely no question that under the circumstances he's going to do what he did. Every flag officer in the Navy would have done the same thing, sail to the sound of the guns. And that brings up the point of how quickly the British war machine is not moving when the Japanese onslaught begins. As Peter pointed out, that first morning of the war, the whole question of whether to send 11th Indian Division down and send it into the defensive position at Chitra, or whether to send it forward into Thailand, precious hours are wasted here as there's dithering at all levels deciding what to do and what not to do. And neither Prime Minister Churchill nor Admiral Pound spend any time at all on that first day thinking about what orders to send out to Singapore. That never really changes. I mean, from that point forward, it's as if the Japanese have free moves to the British Empire, too. They're moving faster, they're outmaneuvering them, and they're constantly putting them on the back foot. They're seizing the initiative and not relinquishing it. But this raises a great problem, because to the extent to which the now allies have been doing any thinking at all about defending Southeast Asia, and there's been a number of conversations about this in the previous 10 months, but no real coordinated decisions have been made. The thinking is that they would defend as an absolute last resort something they called the Malay Barrier, which we can roughly describe as the sort of line of positions that connect Rangoon in Burma to Singapore to what is now Jakarta down to Darwin in Australia. And this is to prevent the Japanese from pushing the Western powers out of Southeast Asia altogether and severing Australia from India and isolating it and cutting it off. And if you lose Singapore, then there goes the entire Malay Barrier, as well as the American outpost in the Philippines. Not only is it in the middle of that line, but it's also the only position with the infrastructure, the fully developed naval base and port and air bases and facilities, which can absorb incoming reinforcements. And that's crucial because this is now a race. The Japanese have triggered a race. A race between their ability to knock Malaya Command back down the peninsula and cut Singapore off, and the ability of the British Empire, on the other hand, to send reinforcements in to try to stop them. And the only place they can do so is Singapore. So this really does remain a major issue of grand strategy. It has to be settled right at the very top. All right, we've lost the initiative. We're on the defensive in Malaya. But what are we going to do now? As of yet, no one has even begun to consider, well, can we do something other than try to hold Singapore? Things are just moving too fast.
And Peter, the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the sinking of the Repulse showed the power of Japanese air power, and that was to be hugely influential during the Battle of Singapore then as well. So you're our air expert. It's interesting to see just how destructive and just how enormous that air power of the Japanese was.
Yes, it was a surprise, though. I mean, this is one of the, I think, entirely reasonable criticisms made of British senior military leadership and indeed political leadership. Huge underestimation of Japanese military capabilities and particularly their air force. Now, it wasn't necessarily the first-rate air force that perhaps the Luftwaffe was, but nevertheless, it was hugely effective. And the Japanese knew they had to gain air superiority, so their initial actions in both Malaya and also the Philippines was to seek out and destroy Allied air power. And they did that very effectively, very quickly. Now, admittedly, the aircraft that Prabhupada had available were fewer than he needed or wanted, and indeed they were perhaps less capable than types available elsewhere. But the Japanese were determined to seize initiative, and they did. And of course, the irony is they then occupied the airfields that had been built in northern Malaya, and they used those forward landing grounds to then harry the British forces. So it was undoubtedly a victory for air power, just as Pearl Harbor demonstrated. And the Japanese, irrespective of the quality of their aircraft, they used their air forces, and both Army and Navy, to huge effect. And it just further made the problem of defending Malaya that much more difficult, because we didn't have the land forces we needed. We didn't have any armor. We had a huge coastline to defend in case the Japanese sort of landed behind the Allied forces. And at the same time, Japanese air force was everywhere, and the Royal Air Force had effectively been shut out of the sky. So, yes, it proved yet again, as we'd already seen in Western Europe, how important air forces were in gaining air superiority. And air power would have been about the only way that the Allies could have at least blunted the Japanese attack, notwithstanding the fact that I think we're all agreed that the outcome was perhaps inevitable, given the fact that Britain was fighting a world war with resources totally inadequate to the task.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and it's one that Brian in Cork has picked up on, and he sent us a very interesting text on 53106. And I might put it to you, Brian, because Brian in Cork wonders whether it was ever feasible for Britain to defend Singapore given the resources that it needed to defend Britain itself.
Honestly, I don't think so, not after the fall of France. I mean, as the years unfold and we see the ramifications of the war coming out in full, it's really obvious what a pivotal, fundamental moment in world history that is, the rapid destruction of the French army by the Germans, also detonates all of Allied planning regarding how to fight this new war. And Britain is, as we all know, pushed onto the back foot, defending itself against possible invasion by a superior force. The circumstances create for the Japanese a tremendous window of opportunity. It's really about the margin of error. It's not impossible, of course, for the British Empire to have put up a stiffer and more determined fight and forced the Japanese to spend more lives and take more time, and who knows what the ripple effects of that might have been. But for the British Empire to have held Singapore under the circumstances prevailing at the time, frankly, the Japanese would have had to make colossal blunders, absolutely egregious blunders, and they did not do so, barring one. That window of opportunity was open, all right, but in order to open it, you had to take the risk of going to war against the United States. So in retrospect, when I look back at the big decisions made at the very top regarding the fundamentals of national survival, frankly, I give the British leadership a higher grade than the Japanese. And the British leadership's determination was, we will do nothing which will jeopardize the chances of rebuilding a coalition that can win this war. And they didn't. They allied themselves with the Soviet Union after the Germans attacked the USSR, and they worked assiduously to bring the United States on board. What did the Japanese do? Already fighting in China, they decided to make an enemy out of the United States. So, yes, they could take Singapore, but look what happened 4 years later.
And Peter, it's very interesting that you have a very intensive aerial campaign followed by an even more intensive land campaign that sees Singapore eventually fall. And it's intense fighting over those weeks.
Yes, and we shouldn't just because the Japanese advance was so rapid, I mean, they captured Singapore in 70 days, we shouldn't forget that, there was a lot of heavy fighting. It wasn't plain sailing by any means. Of course, the Japanese were focused and determined. We talked about their decision-making, but also they were, in many ways, battle-hardened troops. And because of the strains on British resources, the flying squadrons that were there were not filled with experienced personnel. And the same was true of the infantry. I think it was, we shouldn't be surprised at the intensity of the fighting, but equally the fact that the Japanese were able to make such progress. But just changing focus slightly, I think one thing perhaps we ought to think about is that Robert Popham's task was not to win a war against the Japanese. His task was to deter war. And I think that's something that we need to talk through, because the British did not want to fight this war. Brian discussed one of the outcomes, which was that the United States joined the war, and arguably without Pearl Harbor, the war in Europe may have ended quite differently. But he was tasked with improving the defenses and improving cooperation, but he was there to deter the Japanese. And the failure to do so, notwithstanding the logic that said the Japanese should not sensibly attack, the failure to do so, I think, is one that needs sort of further reflection, because you could argue it has parallels today.
Very good. And Brian, in terms of the decision to surrender then, why was that? Was it to do with a desire to protect the city? Was it that they saw defeat being inevitable?
Absolutely. General Percival, the man on the spot, his instructions that Sunday morning remain, you shall carry on fighting until told otherwise. But he's well aware that his army is disintegrating. They still have a great deal of ammunition because of the 6 months supply stored for the original strategy of holding the naval base, but they don't have much else other than sheer manpower. They're coming apart from within at the seams. They can no longer really fight coherently together as an army. They can't contain local setbacks. They can't exploit any local successes. And they've been pushed back to the very edge of the city itself. And this is a city that doubled in size because of the flood of refugees coming down from upcountry. And these are all helpless, unarmed civilians. They are not British. They are British subjects. They are not ethnically British. That's a consideration as well. And Percival is also well aware of what happened in Nanjing in 1937 and the likelihood of what will happen in the city if the Japanese take it by storm, by assault. So his consideration on that morning when he argues that it is time to discuss capitulation is to preserve the civilians of Singapore and his army from an absolute massacre. And while he makes the decision before he receives authorization, it's important to note that this is only due to a time lag in transmitting his directions from London. By this time, the Prime Minister, persuaded by the Chiefs of Staff, has already agreed that no further useful purpose can be gained by holding on and fighting in Singapore, and so he has authorized Malaya Command to surrender. It was reasonable to argue that Percival's army should carry on fighting as long as by doing so it was making some contribution to the wider war. But by those last 48 hours in the middle of February, that was no longer the case. And it's very likely that the last service that General Percival did to his army and to the civilians of Singapore was to effect an orderly capitulation while there was still time to do so, because it's very likely that had the Japanese stormed into the city at the point of the bayonet, then the result would have been a hideous massacre.
Very good. And then in terms of the number of overall casualties, is it true that the large brunt of the Allied casualties were borne by Australian soldiers? And is it true that the casualties were something 3-4 times higher than that of the Japanese?
Both not really correct. I mean, a high percentage of the casualties on Singapore Island were from the 8th Australian Division. This is because they were in the path of the main Japanese attacks on the nights of the 8th and the 9th of February. So that first 2 days of hard fighting as the Japanese blasted their way on shore onto the island and pushed into the interior, that was almost entirely against the Australians. As they pushed into the interior, the rest of the army was engaged as well. Overall, in the campaign as a whole, AIF casualties weren't any more disproportionate than those of 3rd Indian Corps, for example. And on Singapore Island, the Japanese suffered about half the casualties that they took in the entire campaign. So the campaign runs from the 8th of December to the 15th of February. Half the Japanese casualties are suffered in that last week of fighting on Singapore Island. It was a short fight, but it was a sharp fight. However, even there, they inflicted heavier casualties than they suffered.
Okay, very interesting indeed. Okay, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, I'll be talking to an award-winning novelist about what impact this all had on people in Singapore, especially women and children.
Talking history. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the Battle of Singapore, and I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by Jingjing Li, a Singaporean novelist and the author of How We Disappeared, a book set in World War II Singapore, which has been praised as a beautiful, stunningly ambitious novel and praised by the New York Times as a story about memory, trauma, and ultimately love. Jing, it's a pleasure and an honour to have you on the show tonight.
Thank you for having me on.
What prompted you to write this novel and base it on the experiences of young women and children in Singapore during the Second World War?
Well, to be honest, I didn't set out to write a historical novel. And I certainly did not set out to write a novel about comfort women or about experiences of children during the war. I actually started a book based on a character that I had written about in an earlier shorter book. It was a novella with a cast of characters, and one of the characters was an old lady who had been through the war in Singapore. And I didn't know yet exactly what she had been through, but when I finished that book, that earlier book, I felt I couldn't let her go. So I went on to write her in full, if you will, and continue writing her story. And as I did, it came to me what her story was, and this was supposed to be set in Singapore during the war, and it came to me bit by bit. So I didn't set out knowing exactly what I would write.
And you mentioned there comfort women, women who are forced into sexual slavery. Talk to me about that and the experiences of those young women and what they were forced into.
I think most of these women were taken from their families during the war in Asia, the Pacific War, by the Japanese troops, taken by force whenever the troops invaded, and forced into sexual slavery. And most of the time, they were taken away into camps in dangerous war zones, so as to provide sexual comfort for soldiers as they fought. Some of them were shipped out of the regions that they were taken from, and this was especially the case for Korean women who were taken from Korea and put onto ships and taken to China, Mongolia, and Southeast Asia.
And in terms of researching this, how difficult was it to find primary sources? Are there many memoirs or diaries or letters?
Well, surprisingly, there were a lot of archival material available to me, especially online, not just by Korean women, but also from, of course, the Allied sources. I found a lot of interviews, and I also came across this incredible documentary made by a Dutch documentarian who went to Indonesia and found former comfort women who were willing to talk about what happened to them during the war. It's extremely difficult for these women because they were taken when they were very young, some as young as 10. And what happened to them had to be kept secret for a long, long time. And when they talked about this in the documentary, they were already quite old, of course. So it was quite extraordinary to see these elderly women talk about what happened to them when they were children.
And this is an issue that is still controversial today because there is a big debate about recognizing this. There's a big debate about restitution and debates about whether Japan has done enough to apologize for what happened.
Yes, aside from the tension between South Korea and Japan over other issues, this remains a very sore point because I feel that the Japanese government think the South Korean government is using this as a sort of a weapon to push them into portray them as being the victimizers.
And this is an issue that is still controversial today with debates over recognition and restitution and whether Japan has apologized enough.
Yeah, I think this is an issue that plagues South Korea and Japan most of all. And this is a great source of tension between the two countries. For other Southeast Asian countries, I think this is much more to do with the fact that rape is a big taboo. And aside from restitution, the first step, which involves coming forward, still has to be done. And a lot of women have not been afforded that opportunity and have not felt comfortable enough to do that. So the very idea of restitution doesn't come easily.
So in terms of us talking about the Battle of Singapore tonight, this brings home just how difficult life was for young women and children in Singapore during this time.
Yeah, I mean, women and children are always the most vulnerable in terms of war. And in Singapore, I think there was, of course, a lot of malnutrition. A lot of children had to survive on much less than they would have during normal times, and they succumbed to illnesses such as malaria much more easily. There was also a lot of dysentery and typhoid going around. And on a more prosaic level, the women had to do things that they wouldn't have had to do, like they were taken out of school. Children were also taken out of school because a lot of, especially Chinese families, felt they didn't want their kids to be taught Japanese, which was done because Japanese took over and all the Chinese language classes were replaced by Japanese classes. So children were taken out of schools. Women couldn't really go to work anymore because they didn't really want to be seen in public, especially single women. And many of them, like my grandmother, they were pressed into marriage much earlier than they would have. And I think for some of these women, they had to take on life partners that they wouldn't have chosen for themselves.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight to talk about some of these stories. Jingjing Li, a brilliant Singaporean novelist, the author of How He Disappeared. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much. I had a really nice time talking.
We'll be back with more on the Battle of Singapore right after this break.
Talking History. This is News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. As we discuss the fall of Singapore, I'm joined by Professor Brian Farrell, Dr. Peter Dai, and Dr. Ian Speller. And before the break there, we heard from the Singaporean novelist Jingjing Li. Ian, I'd like to ask you about the impact of the fall of Singapore on the naval war. I suppose the war in general, but in particular the naval war, and whether it was transformative in terms of further British actions.
Okay, so I think it's important to recognise that the Japanese offensive is founded on their strength as a maritime power. And with the loss of the Prince of Wales and Repulse off the coast of Malaya, that removed the last thing at sea that could possibly really have stopped the Japanese advance, although, even frankly, the chances were fairly limited there. In the aftermath of that, the British tried to use the surviving destroyers to disrupt the Japanese invasions, but to no avail. And then after the fall of Singapore, there's one further major battle in the region, the Battle of the Java Sea, where a scratch force of British, Australian, American and Dutch cruisers are defeated, and that's kind of the final presence of major surface units within that region. But it's important also to set it in the wider context of what's happening. The biggest defeat wasn't the loss of Prince of Wales and Repulse. The biggest defeat was the American defeat at Pearl Harbor, which takes the American Pacific Fleet out of the equation, because the British rationale had been that the Japanese Navy will largely be fighting the Americans, and that therefore the British on their own wouldn't have to face the main force of the Japanese fleet. With the defeat at Pearl Harbor, that essentially gives the Imperial Japanese Navy freedom to rule the waves for 6 months, until eventually that's overturned at the Battle of Midway. And so you get this Japanese explosion through Southeast Asia, where they expand their empire and they establish a defensive perimeter through the Central Pacific. In terms of the loss of Singapore, that of course denies the British and the Allies a major naval base, and it gives that base to the Japanese. What the British do then is they try to reconstitute their naval power on their base in Ceylon, which is now Sri Lanka. But what they have is a very limited force, and they face the main might of the Japanese if the Japanese determine that they want to turn to the Indian Ocean, which is what they do in March and April of 1942. The main Japanese fleet sorted into the Indian Ocean. And the British Admiral Somerville does the right thing. He avoids them like the plague. He doesn't engage them in a decisive battle. He does try to initiate sort of little hit-and-run strikes of his smaller force. But he's quite clear that the British don't have anything sufficient to deal with the major Japanese Navy. And it's really not until 1944 that they do have. They finally build the Eastern Fleet into what becomes the British Pacific Fleet. And that is a very powerful force. It's probably the most powerful naval force the British have ever sent overseas, built on 4 battleships, 6 big fleet carriers, and over 15 smaller carriers. And that is quite a serious naval capability. But of course, that's slotting into a campaign which is dominated by the Americans, and their fleet absolutely dwarfs the British. And in the period from 42 onwards, the Japanese progressively lose control of the sea, and their empire is rolled back. So the victories in December and January and February of 41-42, it buys them 6 months to play hell in the Pacific and Southeast Asia. But after that, their defeat is completely inevitable.
Very good. Bernard has texted in on 5306 to say that Lieutenant General Arthur Percival served in Ireland during the War of Independence in West Cork, and lots of old IRA were very happy when he surrendered to the Japanese. Brian, there's a lot of myths that surround the Battle of Singapore and the fall of Singapore, and there's sometimes its place is perhaps overemphasised. Winston Churchill is famously quoted as having said that this was a terrible disaster and the worst humiliation. Was Churchill correct, or was he overstating things?
You can certainly see why he felt that way, of course, presiding over it, and the pain and the humiliation was very deep and very bitter. And there were consequences. As Ian just pointed out, the British Pacific Fleet is eventually dwarfed by the American fleet in the final offensive against Japan.
the biggest military consequence of the fall of Singapore is that it knocks the British Empire onto the sidelines in the war against Japan. The United States takes the lead. Up until that point, Britain had been uncontestably the largest and most influential Western power presence in the Far East. Hitherto, that role is going to be assumed by the United States. But actually, taking the longer perspective, which Churchill might have done at the time, historian that he was, I beg to differ with him. I'd say that in terms of the overall consequences of defeat, yes, surrender at Singapore is a deep humiliation. It's a bitter prospect. It's an embarrassment, and it's the loss of a large field army. But it doesn't prevent the Allies from winning the war, not even close. I agree with Ian, it's a 6 months postponement, the Japanese success. And it doesn't even prevent the British from returning and reviving their imperial presence in the Far East after 1945. If we really want to look around for somewhere to stick that label, the worst disaster, I would say that 1781, the Battle of Yorktown, the loss of the American colonies, that's a tangible, massive, fundamental disaster. That loses Britain an entire empire. That helps push British focus to the east in the first place. So we do need to put this in perspective. Yes, for Churchill, it's a deep and bitter and painful humiliation, but it's not a fundamental moment in the global war that we know as the Second World War. It's not Stalingrad. It's not Midway. It mattered, but it wasn't fundamental.
And Peter, would you agree with that, that in terms of the legacy of the battle it has and the fall of Singapore, it's significant, but perhaps not the game changer that it's sometimes presented as?
Yes, I'd entirely agree. I mean, I think if we'd lost the Battle of Alamein later in 42, that would have been much more significant. But there's no doubt about the emotion that swirled around this event. I mean, and that's why the public and politicians were so eager to find an explanation, because it was a shock. And Brooke Popham mentioned Phillips earlier, Percival. They all came in for criticism because it was difficult to rationalize what had happened, because it really did cause people to wonder about the integrity of the British Empire and what the future might hold. So I think it was that emotional reaction that led to some of the over-the-top rhetoric about the significance. But at an emotional level, it undoubtedly was significant. And the rush to find scapegoats was part of that emotional response to what was an unimaginable defeat, even if in retrospect it may not have been as significant as perhaps people claimed.
And Peter, that is really one of the fascinating parts of the story, the search for scapegoats, that it seems that they cast the net fairly widely when they were looking for people to blame.
Yes, and I'm afraid Churchill doesn't come out of this particularly well. I'm not saying that he should be blamed in particular, but The outcome was one that involved many players and a long history, as we've heard, dating back to the 1920s. But I suppose it's a human reaction. It's easier to find someone to blame than to realize that actually it was a combination of issues. It's a more subtle, nuanced explanation. And in wartime, that doesn't really make for good headlines. So, and none of the individuals really, they never were able to cast aside this sort of the criticism, the darkness that settled around them. Percival argued and wrote for many years trying to defend himself. Robert Popham stayed quiet. Phillips obviously died. And Churchill, in a magisterial way, managed to avoid particular criticism, although he did initially, confront it head on. I mean, in Parliament, he made the point that, you know, the weapons, troops, equipment that might have helped Singapore were actually either gone to the Soviet Union or were needed in the Western Desert. None of the key players really recovered in a reputational sense, even though perhaps now we understand there were many more subtleties and nuances to the defeat than perhaps first appeared.
Very good, and we've been teasing out some of those subtleties in tonight's debate. Well, my thanks to my panel of experts, Professor Brian Farrell, who joined us. It's the early hours in the morning for Brian in Singapore, so we're particularly grateful that he was able to take our call tonight. Dr. Peter Dye, former Air Vice Marshal of the Royal Air Force, Dr. Ian Speller of Maynooth University, and earlier we talked to Jing Jing Lee, the Singaporean novelist. Well, that is the end, as I say, of Talking History for another week. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Calhoun, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. Next week, we'll investigate how a kidnapping and murder destroyed an entire family in Northern Ireland in the 1970s. We'll find out about the Cardinal who wrote a poem in favour of Galileo, but later turned against him when he was Pope. And that is the Cardinal, of course, who became Pope. And we'll hear about how Britain's smallest colony became Hitler's island fortress. It's our second January's book show, and we'll have lots more besides. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.